Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Forged by Trust podcast. As always, I am your host, Robin Dreek, the founder and CEO of People Formula, a leadership and communication strategies company, as well as a retired head of the FBI Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, where, yes, my job for my career was recruiting spies. And with me today is a great friend and amazing author, Jeff Gibbard. Jeff is formerly known as the world's most handsome social media and content marketing strategist, and he also goes by another title called Superhero. Jeff is the author of The Lovable Leader, a strategist, and a professional speaker, and the founder of several companies including Super Productive and the Superhero Institute. Jeff helps people to unlock their potential to grow revenues while making a positive impact on the world, and Jeff is also known as the host of his own popular podcast called Shareable. We cover a lot of resources today, including Jeff's amazing book, The Lovable Leader. But we're also going to talk about validating people like a superhero, the three pillars of lovable leadership, how to stay optimistic, and really great news about how to walk into a room. But before we begin, please let me take a few minutes to share how you can support the show. Go ahead and go on to your favorite podcasting platform and leave a like and leave a review. It goes a long way to help get this great content and message out to the rest of the world. Also, please check out the resources in the show notes. I could take a lot of time to put the great links of all the resources that we talk about during the show onto those platforms for you. And also, check out my new self-mastery reading list on my website, peopleformula.com. And help me and help yourself by purchasing any one of my three books, but most importantly, start with a simple primer called It's Not All About Me, the top 10 techniques for a quick rapport with anyone. And with that, sit back, relax, get out that note-taking gear, and join our chat about being a lovable leader.
Robin!
Jeff Gibbard's superhero has entered the room.
What is up, man? I'm super jazzed about this.
Not nearly as much as I am, Jeff. Matter of fact, any day you wake up and say, I get to talk to a superhero is an amazing day.
And it
was really funny because that literally is what popped up on my Zoom. And I see that at Most Awesome Book behind you. I have mine here, The Most Lovable
Thank you,
Leader
sir.
In the World.
Thank you.
I was pouring through your content last night, and I have a plethora of things to chat about. First of all, thank you for having time to chat with me because
oh my God, yeah,
your content is beyond. You are the maestro of production. You're one of these few individuals in life, if not the most prolific individuals, of producing content, all of which I want to consume, which is highly unusual. Usually people put out something like once a week or twice a week, and you are multiple times every day, and all of it is phenomenal.
I wish you could probably,
you have your book out, but you could easily put together an encyclopedia series on everything you do.
Ah, thank you, man. I think I attribute part of it is to like the ADHD mindset of like, I'm just like interested in a million different things, but I think a lot of it is just consistency, right? Like I started blogging back in like 2008 and I just developed a habit for it. I've always been a writer. Right. I got into podcasting in 2013. So then I got a bunch of, I've got, 200 some odd shows there. I start other podcasts because I like that.
I know. I'm about to say not just one podcast, you do multiple podcasts.
Yeah, multiple.
Blows my mind. And I mean, I've already stolen so much from you. One of the greatest things about being a podcaster is you learn so much from your guests. I'm grateful to be able to share it with others, but I'm greedy. I do it all for myself as well.
I say the same thing, man. I'm like, I think every person I talk to is a gift to the audience, but like the first and foremost reason I did is because I get to talk to amazing people and I get to learn from them and I get to hear their story.
Yeah.
And, I really also think it's like for me personally, I see the way you interview. So I'm going to take a gander and a guess that you're the same way, but I enjoy so much the ability to ask somebody a question they've never been asked by someone else. Like to be able to get into a territory that maybe they've left unexplored or that nobody's ever asked them about. And like because I think that's where that connection really happens, right. Is when you get into that stuff.
And I hope I can do that. Who knows? Because you're on so much and you share so much. But with that, it makes a beautiful transition. And here's a question I've never asked because of how you do your bio. And that is, every superhero has a backstory. So Jeff, What's your backstory? How did you become the superhero you are today and arrive at this place where you are so prolific at putting out amazing content about being a lovable leader?
So I think my origin story is, you know, if I were to like point to what of my origin story really resonates most with me, is that I think I've always at heart been, I've had an issue with authority. I've wanted to do my own thing. I've wanted to make a dent in the universe. And I think I've been keenly aware of my own mortality for a variety of reasons. My father was a funeral director, went through a little depressive spout in my early preteens and had like a whatever comes before a quarter life crisis. And watched this movie Dead Poets Society and was like, wow, I have to suck the marrow out of life, right? Like I have to seize the day. I have to, because you never know when your number's going to get called, right? And then to reaffirm that sort of belief in like the impermanence and like the temporality, I guess, of life, like that it's fleeting. On my last day of high school, my mom got into a traumatic car accident where she had a traumatic brain injury. She survived. She was in the hospital for 8 or 9 hours, got nine or 10 pints of blood or something. And she survived, but like, she was almost gone like in an instant. So I've just always had this pressure. I feel like both good and bad, like stress can be both good and bad, but I feel this pressure to make a meaningful impact and leave the world better off than I found it. And so I think part of the, what drives me across everything that I do. So like I guess the moral of the story is like, I'm only here for a little bit. So I'm going to leave it all on the court. And there's a downside to that. But the upside of it is that I put my thoughts out into the world and I'm willing to be wrong. I'm willing to be really wrong. And yeah, where people just want to be seen and where like, you know, people can be who they are. They can be free to be who they are.
And it's beautiful. It's fascinating because your context in which you're framing that, you know, living every day basically as if it might be your last is very stoic. Live as if you might not wake up in the morning. You know, what would you do today if today was your last day? And you seem to have really embraced that because of this origin story of yours, which is touching and profound, which also, yeah, I was just chatting with a good friend of mine a few minutes ago. The way life works, unfortunately, is in order to have that kind of value, you need to have context, and context comes from, and your dichotomy you learned, it sounds like at a young age, was death and life. You know, and so with facing that at a young age, you made a choice. You weren't a victim. And you said, what am I going to do about it? And you are living life to its fullest. The funny thing I found is that you said you can be really wrong. I haven't seen anything really wrong. Superhero Jeff, when have you been wrong?
Oh, man, I've been wrong so many times throughout my life. And, you know, I see my own story as a constant chasing of being a better version of myself. So every project I've ever done, I look back and I think how it could have been better. But even more importantly than that, I think about who I was before I knew more about the world, more I thought about other people. You know, there were definitely times from my past where I was far too sexist for my own comfort, far too racist for my own comfort, just ignorant to the world around me and a product of the you know, world that we grew up in, internalizing certain values, ways of seeing the world. And it's not until you actually listen to other people, you know, read, learn about the world around you in a more holistic way that you can see the error of those ways and the ways that you showed up then. So I think about ways that I showed up all throughout my 20s, all throughout my 30s. And even I'm only 41 now, but even like in the past couple of years, I have things I can look back on and say, okay, learn from that. How do you become a better version of yourself? Any time where you cause harm to another person is an opportunity to learn and grow how to not do that again.
Yeah. Not causing it harm to someone else. And when you do, the pain it inflicts on yourself is immense. And yeah. I share that boat with you, being this extremely horrendous extrovert that is me-centered. When you inflict pain on others, it destroys you internally.
Yeah.
And it becomes your life goal of never doing that again. And inevitably you do. Do you, sometimes people can point to a moment or two or a bunch that resonated strongly with them that kind of made them open like that to realize, I don't have the full picture here. I think there's something I'm missing, or it's just kind of a trickle event, you know, throughout life. Do you have any one or two moments when you're like, oh man, I really was looking at this individual in a very boxed way with, you know, anything like that, that you can think of that caused?
Yeah.
That
I can give moment? A couple that kind of, I think triangulate to give you the picture of it. I think the one is that I remember at an early age growing up and having moments where I was bullied, where I felt other, I felt different. I felt scared. All of the things that you feel like when you're in a bullied situation. And I didn't like the way that I felt there. Right. So there was the feeling of fear from others, that other people could harm me in some way or another. And then during that phase where I was kind of going through like that, you know, young teenage angst thing. I had my own issues with myself. I was short. I was overweight. I had whatever these things were. So I had my own critique and self-perception of myself where I'm beating myself up. And shame. I had a moment where, yeah, but I had a moment where I just, and I remember this moment. It was like clear as day. I might've been like 13 or 14. I don't remember exactly the age where it happened, but I looked at myself in the mirror and I wanted to be taller. I wanted to be thinner. And I didn't want to have like reddish hair. Like, cause these were all the things that I would get bullied or made fun of about. Right. I looked at myself and I basically said to myself in the mirror, I remember this day, like, this is it. Like, this is who you are. Like, you can wish it away all you want, but like, you are short. If you want to do something about your weight, like get under control, do a thing. Your hair is the color it is. Like, accept yourself, love yourself, because that's where it's got to start. Right. And it didn't necessarily sound like that language, cause I'm now 41 recounting it, but I remember having the moment looking at myself and just saying, you got to accept this, right?
So, how old were you again when you said it? 13?
I was like 14, 13, 14. I had like a major early
that
life thing going on.
Crazy self awareness at such a young age. I mean, your EQ, I mean, your emotional intelligence at that age, you know, for anyone's age, it's pretty low because it's so look at me, look at me, look at me. But you had a profound EQ accelerator moment at that age. Wow,
yeah,
good on you for that.
I give a lot to my parents in that, you know, specifically like my dad. I think he was very instrumental in kind of just asking me questions. And I don't remember exactly what he said around them, but I remember it was around a time where he was kind of just asking me to question why I wouldn't accept myself or whatever the different things were. Right. So there's those. And then I think, so that's the history, right? And then sort of the catalyzing moment, that's the trigger. And I guess the action for me was there were points throughout, especially my early 20s, where I was not the person that I thought in my head that I was, right? Like I loved Superman from the moment I was a little kid. I was all about the superhero thing. And I had this high self-image of myself, right? And then I did things that I saw the impact of it, how it did not make people feel respected, didn't make them feel safe, didn't make them feel however. And I looked at how, and these are sometimes with people who were close friends of mine, I looked at how that interaction, you know, caused our friendship to fall apart or whatever. And I knew that I was causing them to feel a way that I had felt early in life, that I was being the thing that potentially made them feel the way I did when I was a kid being bullied or whatever. And I think that almost made me like recall my trauma through their trauma. And I think from that is why I've spent a lot of time trying not to do that, trying to make right. people feel seen, to make people feel appreciated, to make them feel like they're enough. Like one of the things I do on my podcast, and this isn't like a tactic or a strategy, like you and I talk about trust a lot. And we talk about like, it's really got to be about the other person. It's got to be authentic. I try to look for things to acknowledge and appreciate about people. I try to find the reasons why they're amazing. I really try to point it out for them because oftentimes they don't see it themselves.
Right.
And I do that not because it's like, oh, I'm going to butter them up so I can hit them with a sales pitch afterwards. I do it because I feel like, well, that might make their life completely turn around. Like they might have their 14-year-old moment, look at themselves in the mirror and go, you know what? I'm really awesome at sales, or I'm really, really good at building relationships, or, oh my God, I can really, you know, build something better than other people. Like I should be proud of that. And I should take that with me, you know?
You know, and that is a... It's one of those elusive, obvious things in life where the insecure think that you can't give power away because then you'll have less power because you know, all these people want to crave power and control. Yet the best thing you can do for yourself, for anyone else, is show gratitude. Define and find their greatness. Share, help them understand what it is. Share it with the world because one, you're being of service. And the greatest thing you can do for others is be of service, obviously. And it's actually... what it does for us psychologically provides us emotional comfort as well, because all human beings, you know, we're genetically and biologically coded to crave and seek psychological comfort. The best way to give it is to validate the strengths, seek the strengths, and you give yourself such a positive confirmation bias when all you're doing is seeking the greatness in others. You know, you're going to find it. And it'll be in the most unusual places, and you'll be amazed and profoundly impacted sometimes. So when you first discovered this in the 20s, you know, in your 20s, what were some of the first actions you did? You know, it's like, all right, I'm causing some pain here in others. Wasn't my intent, you know, because again, you and I can relate on this. I did the same thing. Was there anything consciously you started doing in that, or were you just aware?
I think, well, awareness is definitely the starting point, because I think that's the first roadblock to anybody that doesn't make those sort of changes, that just continually harms others. And I think there's an expression, hurt people hurt people. And yeah. I think anytime I've looked at myself and seen something in me where I'm causing others harm, I think, what's going on in me that's making that happen? And I didn't start therapy until I was much older. But I remember after I got divorced, it was the first time I actually saw a therapist. But in my 20s during that time, I definitely sought the comfort and the counsel of friends and other people. Like I would, you know, sort of informal therapy of sorts,
right,
and sure. trying to get other people's perspectives, really just trying to be a good listener. You know, much like you, I'm a stick of dynamite type extrovert. So it takes something for me to shut my mouth and just listen and actually hear other people, even though I'm like, you know, ferociously interested in other people. It's really hard not to just like ADHD talk over them and just, you know, extrovert, but I tried listening a lot. And then I think the other thing that I've really retreated to, I feel like I've turned to as an asset, but I've also I say retreated purposefully because I find a lot of comfort and safety in going and working on myself by learning. So on my various different profiles, like Myers-Briggs and DISC and Enneagram, like my desire for self-improvement is like at the top of the chart. Right. So I read a lot to try and learn more about the world around me. And that has tended to be one of the first places that I go. So like for the last several years, I've really been spending a lot of my time reading, learning about people who have different experiences than I do in this world, specifically in this country, and looking at the history of those sorts of experiences and trying to empathize and imagine myself in that position and try to think through if that's happening, what are some solutions to that? How can I be a part of affecting the change so these sorts of things don't happen? So in my 20s, I just started an early version of that. And I think I just got better at it over time.
Can you remember the first book that you read and the self-improvement that, you know,
100%. We probably share it. I'm willing to almost bet that we would say the same book. How to Win Friends and Influence People. Yep.
This is my first copy.
Literally the most important book I think I've ever read. And here's a big thing about that. That book wasn't just the most important book that I had ever read, like from the text and like what it did for me as a person relative to the content of the book. Robin, that was the first book I ever enjoyed reading. Prior to that, I did not enjoy reading at all. And the reason is that throughout school, I was forced to read things that I neither cared about reading nor was interested in reading. It was all fiction. I had a hard time focusing on it because of my ADHD. I would forget characters' names and things. So I had a really hard time reading certain types of books, and How to Win Friends and Influence People was the first book where I was like, oh my God, are you telling me that there are manuals out there that I can read that will help me to grow and become superhuman? What? So it actually unlocked reading for me. And since that time, I've probably read hundreds of books at this point from that moment. And I started so late in my life that book was the trigger. But yeah, that book changed everything for me. I remember from that book, I'll tell you one of the big things from it was there's the quote in there where I think he quotes William James, where he says, human beings' greatest desire in life is to be acknowledged. And I was like, oh my God, that is so profound and so true that we just want to be validated and seen that that our existence is enough and that we matter and that our contributions are worth something. So I focused from that moment on doing that, on focusing on like what I said about my podcast guests, focusing on things that I love about people and what makes them great rather than trying to pick them apart and find out what's wrong.
Because I guarantee you a couple of things of human behavior that are guaranteed. Human beings were all seeking psychological comfort. And that's what Dale Carnegie talks about, is how do you provide psychological comfort for all? And those are you encounter. And the other thing that's guaranteed to all human beings is we're all working on something. We're born pretty perfect. The world messes up for about 19 years. We spend the rest of our lives overcoming our insecurities.
Yeah.
If you look for someone's faults, I guarantee you'll find them. If you look for someone's greatness, I guarantee you'll find that. So perfect. And yes, your guess is right. That was my first aha moment as well, when I realized that books can be manuals. And when you have someone introduce a great book like that to you and they teach you how to use it as a manual, that was what was critical for me. Was, hey, you take notes in the margin, you go out, you read, you then practice, you then after action yourself, you reflect, you read again, you go practice again. And that became the sequence of, wow, I can become a better human being. And you just took it to the next level in the whole area of being the lovable leader. And boy, there's so many rabbit holes we could go down and everything. So we haven't even talked about the things I want to talk about yet, but we're going to, because I really want to hit the three pillars of lovable leadership that this brought you to. So expand on that if you would, because the most important thing is podcasts are also learning venues, and I want people to be able to understand these three pillars and start enacting at least one of them by the end of this show.
Oh, absolutely. And Robin, I love talking with you, man, because I feel like we could do it for hours and hours. We have so many overlapping and aligning interests. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of the things in my book. I know that we align on so many of them. So the three pillars of lovable leadership, and just to kind of quickly set the context, 20 seconds, that I wrote this book because I was tired of the way that I saw leadership being talked about and being done. It was all about results, and it was all about, in so many ways, domination and control. I'm not about that life. I'm about, and I'm psychologically unemployable. So like, I cannot work for anybody else. So I tried to figure out like what,
I'm psychologically unemployable. Love that. I now have a new phrase I can use. Yes.
Yeah. No, like it just doesn't work. So I had to figure out like, well, let me approach it from, let me crack the code of like, what's a company I could work at? And I tried to boil it down and boil it down and boil it down until I distilled like, what are the core components that make an environment that I think I could exist in, but that also I think that other people are looking to be in. And this is where I came up with the three pillars. So three pillars are care, trust, and safe travels. And I'm going to explain them all briefly. So care is about care for the people that are, you know, on your team, care for each other. It's also about care for the work and the integrity of the things that you're doing together. So care is, I think, the foundational, is the fertile soil in which everything else grows. Trust, as you know very well, is essential to even being able to create teams that are resilient, that are able to, you know, persevere through challenges. They're able to stick together. It's all of those things. And I built a framework in my book that is derivative of yours 100%. Like, there's no question that your book, The Code of Trust, inspired my work on trust, is directly influenced by your work, The Code of Trust. So trust is being an essential component of being an excellent leader. If there's no trust, it just breaks down. And the third piece, which is a reimagining of what we typically talk about in leadership, which is results, right? So as a leader, you need to be going somewhere. You need to bring people to a destination. I think of this, the analogy I use all the time for this is, let's say that as a business, the metaphor here is you're in New York and you want to get to Los Angeles. That's the goal. It could be a certain amount of profit rise, whatever, this and that and the other thing. Well, let's imagine that you get on the plane. That's an easy way to get from New York to Los Angeles, right? You know the direction, you know where you're going. However, it's not enough to get on the plane and say, we're going to go from New York to Los Angeles, because if at 30,000 feet, the door's open, everybody flies out the door. It's not a particularly good way to get from New York to Los Angeles. Right. So you also have to have safety. You have to have confidence that if we're going to go to that direction, that I'm going to be safe to give my best, that I'm going to be free to let go and enjoy the ride together. And I think the idea of safe travels is saying that it's not just about the destination. It's also about how we get there together. So the safety element, the psychological safety, the creating the opportunity for people to bring their best selves to work. I think all three of these elements kind of combine to give you an environment that just about anybody could work in. If you feel cared for, you trust the people around you, you trust the people that lead you, you trust the people that you lead, and then you set destinations that you create the conditions where everyone's going to feel safe getting there and bringing their best selves, I think you've got an opportunity to build a world-class team no matter what.
Totally agree, 100%. And that safe travels is critical for innovation, because if people don't feel safe, you know, emotionally, physically, spiritually, whatever it is, they're not going to innovate. And innovation is the only thing that solves challenges and problems. So I'm curious. So that safe travels is so important to create that psychological safety for people, because they can innovate through any challenge when they're facing that. From your experiences of consulting, working with people, how do you take someone or an organization that doesn't provide that psychological safety? What specific things can you do to provide safe travels?
So I would say, and I'm not an expert on this topic, but I would double underline, exclamation point, and highlight in bold how important this is. But I would probably start with diversity, equity, and inclusion training and understanding that organizationally, because I think that's actually one of the first steps. If you can't nail that, you can't nail anything else. So I would say the very, very first thing is about being able to create an environment that is safe and free for literally everyone. And I think that is the very, very first thing. Now, I think there's a lot of things that are going to follow that, or that are going to intersect with that very, very tightly. And I think a lot of that comes around guidelines and expectations. And it's also about, I think, setting examples and about what is allowed and not allowed, and not in terms of like rigid rules, but more in terms of like, what do we expect from one another about how we're going to interact with each other? I think that is such a critical piece about being able to create environments of safety, because you need to be able to know that when you put forth an idea, you're not going to be criticized for that idea in a brainstorm. Right. That's silly. It's counter to the idea of a brainstorm, right? You need to understand the people that you're working with have a commitment to your growth, and you should have a commitment to theirs. You have to have the sort of opportunity to take ownership over your work, because we know autonomy is such an incredibly important part to people feeling connected to their work, to employee engagement and retention. So there's all of these elements. I actually write about something in the book called The Eight Commitments of the Team. And those eight commitments are what I think are kind of like the big eight things that if you're a team and you have all these things, I can list them real quick. You have safety and protection, communication guidelines, alignment, ownership, growth, courage, resilience, and cooperation, collaboration. So those eight, I think when you bring them together and you have a team that exhibits all of those things and you set the expectations that that's what's going to happen, you create the conditions where when things do go out of bounds, as they inevitably do, humans, we mess up, you create the resilience and you create the systems by which you can bring things back together.
So in the area of communication, out of those eight things, what sort of things do you recommend people do for communication?
So my philosophy is that communication should be kind, candid, clear, and direct. And that might not be the exact things I wrote in the book, but the idea is that essentially we should be able to speak freely and honestly to one another, clearly, and with kindness. And that's not the same as being nice, but it harkens back to the first pillar of lovable leadership of care, which is that if I care about you and I trust you and we're going to go to the same place together, then I should be able to tell you what's going on. I should be able to tell you if you've hurt me. You should be able to tell me if I've hurt you in some way, as I like to say, that we are on each other's sides to try and resolve this. Like, it's not about, you know, keeping score or, you know, tracking who's got more integrity points, but more about like, well, how do we just resolve this thing together? So in the communication guidelines, it's really trying to get people to understand how not to talk to one another and how to talk to each other. Like, what's effective, what's not effective, placing blame, calling names, anything like that is not going to be useful. But if we can be honest, if we can be clear and we can be direct with one another with kindness, it's going to work out really well, I think.
What guidance and strategies do you have for, I'd imagine, the most challenging aspect of communication like that, where it's caring as well as direct, from people taking it too personally?
Ooh. Well, I mean, I think this is a rabbit hole we could go super deep down, because I really think that that's based on how much trust there actually is.
Right.
Because I think that if you're, think about like your very best friend. Your very best friend could say something completely off the wall that they don't even think about the impact of it. It could be really hurtful. It could be really offensive. But you've known this person for 15 or 20 years. You know the person that they are. And they've got enough stored in the bank of trust that you're willing to say, hey, I don't think you meant to say it exactly that way. Why don't we try that again? I want to let you know how that made me feel. But here's what's going on. You talk about it, right? I think the problem is when people will take it personally if they don't trust your intentions, like at all, right? Yeah. Or if there's unspoken things that they've been holding on to, right? Like if you've got two people that are just upfront with one another, they trust each other, they like each other enough, there's nothing that they're holding on to. Transgressions are dealt with in that moment. They're a thing that happened and you work with it, right? By contrast, if you've got stuff that you're holding on to, that means so much more, because it's not just about that thing. It's about that thing on top of all of the other stuff. That time you did it last time, you always do this, you never do this. When you've got that kind of baggage, then it becomes personal. The other side of it, which is, I think, the probably the more common thing that happens, which is why do people take things personally? And we slightly touched on this earlier, we are all just bundles of trauma walking around. It might not even be you and what you said to that person, but it's what they've gone through. I actually just wrote a post about trauma in business that, you know, I gave this example of like, this woman works at this company and she wasn't properly onboarded. And in her last company, they didn't properly onboard her. Every company she's ever worked in, she basically had to figure it out for herself. And that now is her way of being, right? So when she goes to a new company, she's fine. She'll figure it out herself. So what happens when somebody comes onto her team? Of course, she's not going to onboard them properly because she's never been onboarded properly. So she's just going to say, well, they'll figure it out themselves. I always had to do that. That's business trauma, right? And we all walk around with our stuff, right? Like, I've got all sorts of trauma about work, about what I believe based upon the stuff my parents went through, based upon the stuff that I went through in early jobs and how I was treated. And then you have a reaction to that when somebody may very innocuously and who's on your side may say something and you go, you know what? I'm not going to take one for the team, because every time I've ever taken one for the team, X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So each situation is different, but people, we're all a collection of individuals with our own individual traumas. These aren't rational, logical things. Oftentimes it's emotional. It comes from somewhere that may or may not have anything to do with you. So if we extend empathy and we get curious and we ask people about that, and you really try to be on the same side of the table with them, I think you can work through things like that.
You brought up a really powerful concept there in the fact that when you have situations like that, like the woman you talked about, where she had to basically onboard herself multiple times, what that is you become self-reliant, self-dependent, and which is about self. It's centric, egocentric, and not, and you know, again, you put the negative connotation aside, it becomes egocentric, which is about power. And as vice, you know, conversely, which is leadership, which is about others. And so you, especially, you know, you growing up, when you face trauma, when you face challenges, when you face bullying, and you don't have a support network, and it all comes down to self-reliance, and you're an extrovert, so you've got popularity bleeding into these things. It keeps reinforcing self, 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 self. And when you finally have a position where you need to exercise leadership, which is about others, you don't have the tool set because it's always been negatively reinforced that I need to take care of myself. I need to take care of myself. And so that's where that more trauma keeps cascading until you have those aha moments.
100%.
That was literally one of the aha moments I recently read. Again, voracious reader, probably not nearly as much as you, in Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power.
Yeah.
And I had this aha moment, like, wow, there's this thing called power, and it's the opposite of leadership because power is about self. And I started reflecting, kind of like you did right there, about all these events in life, especially when we're younger, when these things get reinforced, that, wow, it was literally me being self-reliant and an extrovert and trying to crave popularity, which was my undermining at a young age, which I think many people experience.
Yeah,
that's why great, strong leadership, it's a journey, because we're not really bred for it. We're bred for survival, which is about self, which I think it's another good segue to talk about. How do we create then, as you talk about, I love the phraseology, how do we create these really important moments that kind of set the stage for us to move forward in life?
That's a tough one, because that's a big question you just offered there. You know, one thing,
any rabbit hole you want, pick one.
Yeah, man. I would say one thing that occurred to me is, you know, kind of tying those two, like what we were just talking about to what you are talking about now, about, you know, how do you look for those moments? I think there's an awareness that I think comes from the question, either what is this person protecting themselves from, or what am I protecting myself from? Right. Oh, you know, we as humans are looking for that psychological comfort. We're looking for safety. We're looking for security, try to avoid pain. We try to run towards pleasure whenever possible. So what am I protecting myself from right now? Who am I protecting? Am I protecting myself? Am I protecting my team? So looking for those moments where you can remove yourself from an automatic reaction and instead try to be proactive around making a conscious decision about what's currently going on, right? Like, I guess I could say in that moment where I was 13 or 14, the real, real, real background stuff was having an understanding that I was trying to in some way enforce something in my life that wasn't likely, right? That I was trying to protect something, and that the easiest way to protect myself from my own criticisms was just to accept myself in that moment. And granted, that wasn't the actual thought process of a 13, 14-year-old.
Right.
But that's actually what was really, I think, the net effect of it, was that I decided that the threat was coming from inside the house and I just had to get rid of it. I had to say, I'm fine, who I let go of it, right? And I think a lot of the moments that at least I've noticed in my own world is realizing that whatever the action I was doing, that I'm no longer fond of how that made me feel or how it made others feel, was that it came from some place of protecting myself from embarrassment or from something I was scared of that might've been based on faulty information, any number of different things. Like, you know, how would I be perceived? All of these different things. When you ask yourself, what am I protecting myself from? And you recognize it, you have the option to at least choose a different path. So I would say that's one of the ways that I would look out for it, is when you reach one of what feels like it might be a big moment, and we have a gut feel for it. Mm-hmm. I would say, ask yourself, am I protecting myself from anything right now?
That is profound, because it's also demonstrating an extremely high level of self-awareness. And that's another huge rabbit hole. Did you ever become conscious of the fact that, wow, I am actually kind of become a little more actualized and self-aware? Do you have anything you actually do to maintain that self-awareness? And granted, I think this question that you asked yourself is phenomenal. What more? Because it is a critical skill, I think, to becoming that lovable leader is to know yourself in a healthy way, you know, faults and everything, but without shame. So how do you become more self-aware? What's part of your practice?
This is a juicy steak that you've just served up right here. And I'm so ready to cut into this because, and I can't tell you
do my dance.
I can't exactly tell you where it comes from. I guess I could kind of postulate where maybe it comes from, but like I am on a constant path towards becoming the absolute best version of myself. And I've just always seen that whether it's self-assessments or external assessments are a good way of gathering data to understand where to go to work, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's going to reveal things where you say, well, this is a weakness that I can and should shore up. And then there's other times where you say, you know, this is actually, I'm comfortable with this as a weakness because we can't be good at everything, right?
Right.
But I think the first time I took Myers-Briggs, which, you know, criticisms of the assessment aside, scientific validation and blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
Great. Doesn't matter to me. Point is, it was something interesting. I could look at it and say, oh, this is an archetype, right? There are other people who are like this. One, I'm not alone. There are others like me. Two, there are certain characteristics that I can be now more aware of. These are ways that I am, right? I took DISC. And for me, the Enneagram was like a huge one for me. And all of these, I don't put like a stamp of like 100% approval on these things, but I think they're interesting pieces of data to look at. And when I did right. the Enneagram, I went down like this deep, dark rabbit hole of like really learning about my type, the particulars of my thing. I'm an 8 wing 7. And I'd learned a lot about people who are like that. And I felt really seen. I felt very validated. Like, oh, this is who I am. But you also get to learn like both the strengths of a personality like that, and you learn the weaknesses of a personality like that. And then you get to choose what to do with that. Right. So I know, and you and I are similar in this, in that, you know, we're this blaring extrovert, like our instinct, our inside of us makes us want to talk over people and burst into a room and take it over. Right. That's inside of us. We need that. There's something there for it.
Right.
But we know that. So we can choose to let ourselves do that. We can choose strategically to let ourselves do that. In certain times we're like, you know what? I need this. And this is the right room for it. And I feel like it's going to be well received and okay. And then there's other times where you go, you know what? I do this a lot. And maybe it's time that I instead shine the spotlight on someone else. I step back so that other people can have that moment as well. So I think just being aware of your stuff is a really, really good starting point.
Right.
And I think if I had to guess where it comes from for me is like this whole superhero thing, right? Like, how do I self-actualize myself into someone who can change the world, who can protect others, who can make an indelible mark in the world? How do I do all of that? Well, I got to constantly be improving and working on myself, never being satisfied. And there's downside to that, but the upside of it is that I am always working on myself to try and be better.
So you are a superhero. What are your superpowers?
Someone asked me that question not long ago, and I gave an answer to it, and they mirrored back to me something different. And I've been going with that ever since. So my friend Tony Chapman asked me on the mic swap on my show, what's your superpower? And I can't remember what I said at the time. Communication, a connection, sales, I don't know. He said something. Mm-hmm. And he said, interesting. I would say that your superpower is resilience and reinvention. Mm. And I hadn't thought of it because I think, you know, I told the story about my mom, parents divorced. I told, you know, there's all sorts of stories throughout my life that are opportunities where I could have just stopped pushing forward on something. But I always really admired the whole like Rocky, you know, it's not how hard you get hit. It's whether you keep getting back up sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. For some reason that always resonated with me. Like I don't really have the quit thing in me. And I think that being just a part of me is what causes me to kind of keep going the way that I go. So I think the superpower is the resilience, is to get back up, is to keep being hopeful that there's something better out there. And I hope that I always hold on to this as a superpower because I feel like it's the thing that's gotten me through a lot of really rough times in my life to just feel like I could get back up, that there's still a chance for things to get better, even no matter how dark things get. Like I get in my way where I look at the world and I'm like, oh God, things are so messed up and this and that. But I always try to pull myself back out of that and remain hopeful that things can be better. And I think the resilience is the one piece. And I think related to that, as my friend Tony said, is the reinvention. You can't just get back up and keep trying to do the same thing that got you knocked down in the first place. You have to rethink where you're going. You know, right now, my title is superhero and I wrote a book on leadership. But like, if you talk to me 8 years ago, I was the guy everybody knew as the social media guy. My headline at the time was the world's most handsome social media and content marketing.
I saw that. Yeah.
Good branding. But that was my thing. That was what I was into. And I got to a point where I was no longer into that. I didn't like what social media was doing to society. And I said, you know what? I got to reinvent what I'm doing. I got to figure out what was it that got me jazzed in the first place. Let me see if I can find something else that does that. And I think that's probably what my superpower is the ability to keep getting back up. And when I get back up, decide if I need to reinvent myself to keep moving forward.
I'm going to add one thing to your superpower that I see overarching all these things, and that is optimism. I see you as eternally optimistic, because none of these things can be affected unless you maintain a optimistic viewpoint of the world. And it's not rose-colored glasses, because I think you come across very pragmatic and realistic, even though you are a superhero. But this eternal optimism keeps that ball rolling forward. Because if you just thought, if you had despair, everything else would fall apart. So how do you maintain such great optimism, whether you even know it or not?
I don't know if I know how I can keep looking for the bright side of things, except if I like really, really dig into it and try to think of it, is that I don't think that I could live with the alternative. Like I honestly think that what keeps me going in life is the belief that things will get better, and the belief that I might be able to make an impact. And that if I give up on that, I may be one of the critical pieces to make it get better, right? Like we all have an impact on the world, whether it's like, I think people get really like hung up on like to change the world is to like literally change the entire world. But I guess I've maintained that small things make a big difference sometimes. And I feel like my presence, even if it's just that I make the people around me feel validated and maybe I empower someone to do something extraordinary by way of them interacting with me, that contribution alone, I feel like I'm contributing towards making the world a better place. And if I don't do that, if I don't keep trying to bring brightness and positivity and optimism into the world, if I don't keep treating people the way that I want to treat people, make them feel validated and seen, then I'm relinquishing my say, my vote in the type of world that we want. And I think that's irresponsible. So I think that's probably where it comes from for me, is like, I feel a profound sense of responsibility to be optimistic in the midst of all of this, because otherwise I'm just letting it happen.
So kind of exploring that one little nugget further, I'm curious. So when you see events happening that some might give labels of tragic, horrendous, horrible, do you see it as a learning moment and a gift because of the learning moment that we can take, learn, and pass on? Or is it just merely a horrendous event that impacts us negatively?
I think it's both, to be honest, because there's nothing that I see that's like horrendous and horrific and causes any form of human suffering that I'm like, oh, well, collateral damage, like none of that, like suffering in
definitely
general,
flipping,
just,
right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like it always affects me, but I always see that. Every single time I see something like that, I feel like this should be the wake up that this is the last time. Right. Right. And I look around, for what, everybody. No, we're not. So
there definitely is no last time. I mean, as another voracious of a reader of history and books, yeah. There is no last time, because we've always been here before. And speaking of my love of Battlestar Galactica, all this has happened before and all this will happen again.
Yeah. But like great example, right? Like you walk by someone who's homeless on the street. That's a lesson. We should look at that and say, we should not allow this in society. Like people should have a roof over their heads. Like we're better than this, but at the same time, it's still profoundly tragic. And that goes for anything, whether it's war, whether it's famine, whether, whatever it is in the world, even if it's just like you have an awful experience at work and two people fight about something, like that's a lesson, but it also could be at the same time tragic for the person who's dealing with whatever trauma they may take from that.
Right. Big believer. And you can't change the world, but you can make a difference one person at a time.
Yeah.
And that's 100%. If everyone just made a difference one person at a time, it makes a profound difference.
And you know what? I talk about that stuff a lot. And I feel like people roll their eyes at the idea that you can make a difference one person at a time. People like really, they think like, oh, that's so Pollyanna. That's so like new age. No, it's just straight math, as you've demonstrated there. You know what I mean? Like you literally,
he ran the numbers.
Everybody was. And it could, and the other thing that's crazy to me is that it could happen instantly. Like, yep. We could literally decide tomorrow that we're just going to change, because it's all made up, everything. We're making it all up as we go along. And I just think, you know, if we made it up and we decided that the North Star that we're going towards together is a better world where we treat each other with kindness and compassion and all of that, like, I think we'd just have a better world. And we can go super far down that, but
yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's a great segue to a final question, because as we said, I could go forever talking to you. And matter of fact, just talk about that whole change in the world thing. Types of reading I love to do is the self-awareness stuff. So I read Eckhart Tolle as well. And his last book I read, A New Earth, talks about just that, you know, with their own personal mindset and making those differences one person at a time, of living in the now, living in the present, and taking care of others with the kindness. It does make a huge impact. And even, you know, individuals like you that do this great work with C-suite executives and all the people that think the type A's or organizations that are full of bureaucracy can't do that. Yeah, can. One person at a time. It's not that hard. So, and the final thing I wanted to ask you, because I was intrigued by it, and that is, I think it kind of wraps all these things together, that whole first impression. So with all this packaging you do, with this self-awareness, how do you walk into a room?
Oh, man. So there's a couple ways to answer that. I just wrote a post recently called How to Walk into the Room. And it's about like the first impression you make with a new team.
I saw it. That's why I asked it. I loved it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I would say if I'm looking at the most common way that I enter the room, my first impression is very, very, it's very loud and it's very strong and it's fast and it's ADHD. And so, I mean, that's the standard. How I try to walk into the room is I very much try to be aware of deliberately slowing down to assess things, not talk as much, listen more, ask more questions. Like, that's what I'm working on. That's like the Jeff project of how to walk into a room. the standard Jeff walk into the room is that guy that's inside of me that wants to take in, wants to dominate, wants to be the most important person in the room, that wants everyone to think he's the smartest person in the room. Like, that's the guy that's inside that's trying to, you know, protect his image, that, you know, I need everybody to see me a certain kind of way. But what I'm trying to do before I walk into a room, before I make a first impression, is try to think, well, how can I best serve the people in this room? Is it by coming in and being the smartest person in the room? Or is it by coming in and listening and actually trying to gather where I could make the biggest impact? So I guess how I walk into a room versus how I should walk into the room, maybe two different things a lot of the time, but I know how I want to walk into a room.
Ah, I like that. Basically assessing, slowing down, assessing, what does the room actually need from Jeff before Jeff gives the room what I want to give it?
Yeah. Cause it's easy to lean on your strengths, you know, like to think like, this is my value. Right. And I think that's where that comes from, is saying, this is what my value is, when really, like, maybe you actually have more value than you're giving yourself credit for. Maybe you're not just the guy that knows how to strategize. Maybe you're not just the guy that like comes in and brings good ideas. Maybe you're not the guy who can just build things. Maybe you have other value, and you got to give yourself the opportunity to let people tell you what that is, because you may not know.
Yeah. And Jeff, I think you do a phenomenal job of what I think most people wish they could do in life. And that is discover what their weaknesses or challenges are and make it their life's journey to not have them the same by the time we pass on to whatever is next. So thank you for that and sharing that journey with us. What didn't I ask you that you thought would be really critical to share with an audience before we depart?
Oh man. I don't know, Robin. I feel like there's like 10,000 things that I still want to sit down and talk with you about, because I think we have a lot of things that overlap. We see a lot of the world and like some of its problems and some of the things that are opportunities the same way. So I can't think of just one thing. I just want to express gratitude for you having me on your show. When I first read your book, I was like, there's no way I'm ever going to get to meet and talk to this dude. But here we are, and we're meeting and we're talking about it. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to sit and talk with you about this stuff.
And meanwhile, as I told you in an email, your book, The Lovable Leader, is the book I wish I could have written, because you made my content so much better, and you wrote it so much better, and you share it so much better. Everything's
hilarious
better,
for
better,
you to
better.
Say that. Cause when I wrote to my, so when I started talking to my publisher before I ever put out the book, they were like, how do you envision your book? I was like, all right, I want it to be a mix of like how to influence and influence people, the code of trust. And then I listed off like three or four more books. And what was the other one? The Coaching Habit. I think I gave like a bunch of different books. I was like, it's a mix between these. So yeah.
Well,
inspiring one another. Let's do it.
You did it. You did a phenomenal job. Jeff, where can people find out more about you? His content is phenomenal. There is no bad content I've seen from you. Where can they go to get it?
Thank you, sir. I make it really easy to find me now. I put together this site, just jgibbard.com, and it actually is like a menu. What are you looking for from Jeff? You're looking for content? Yeah. Here you go. You're looking for working with Jeff? There you go. You're looking for my social? There you go. So it's really the Jeff menu. And it basically is a series of nested menus that bring you to whatever it is that you're looking for me. If you just want to follow me on Twitter, great. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter, there's links there. Everything you could possibly want that is Jeff, that's the place to get it. Even my side projects. If you just want to look at all my stuff I'm doing on the side, I got an Instagram account of what I'm cooking. Like, follow it if you feel like it. It's all there.
Jeff, I can't thank you enough for sharing your time. You are exceptionally busy. I still have no idea how you put out so much content, and being able to carve out a little bit of time with me, this audience, my audience is, we're just grateful, extremely grateful. Hopefully everyone's got some new tools to walk away from. I know I do. I got my notes. I have more notes. I have just oodles of Jeff notes. And Jeff, with that, I thank you. And I can't wait to continue the conversation and see you all soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. If you enjoyed the show, took away a few new tools, I hope you will leave a great review of the show to show your support. If you are interested in more information about how to forge your own trust-building strategies, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. You can also follow me on my social media sites included in the show notes. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust episode with you soon.